This week on the Canadian Tech Podcast, we really live up to our name. We talk about BlackBerry's latest acquisition, the new skinny cable plans, and Microsoft finally unifies the Xbox and Windows gaming platforms. That's all this week, and a lot more on the Canadian Tech Podcast.
Welcome to the Canadian Tech Podcast, episode 62 for Wednesday, March the 2nd, 2016. My name is Stuart Clark.
My name is Derek Silva.
And I'm Jameson Roberts.
Well, gentlemen, weather-wise, we had a bit of a blizzard through here in lovely southwestern Ontario, but I think we got off lucky compared to some folks, although I haven't been outside. Jameson, I know you're one that walks to work. What were the sidewalks like today?
Not fun.
Not fun? You skated in. You skated into the cube then.
Yeah, I pretty much skated into the cube. It wasn't so much the snow, it was the layer of ice underneath. So
yeah, I worry about that when I go out onto my porch because I have a very good neighbor that snowblowed out the driveway, but I still have to shovel the steps, so I'm worried about doing some, you know, swan dive or anything off the steps, you know, and there'll be no one there to judge me. Derek, how were the roads this morning?
Actually, the roads weren't that bad. My wife and I decided to carpool today, so only one of us would be, only one car would be on the road, and it was the one with snow tires. So, I drove over to the East End, just on the east side of downtown, and then came back downtown and parked, and things were a little slow, but really not any worse than they've been at other times this season, since the temperatures have gone up and down quite a bit and things have frozen and thawed out again and again. I find myself a pretty confident driver, so I handle things pretty well, I believe.
Cool. Excellent. Could have been worse. You didn't cause any accidents? So
cause any accidents. Buses were canceled this morning, but... and frankly, I don't know if my oldest went to school or not. The book fair started yesterday, and today was his class's designated book buying day. So I'm really hoping he went. If not, I'm sure he can get in there later this week. So
exactly.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I'll find out when I get home.
Cool. Awesome. Well, the good news is we will have double-digit temperatures next week. So
yes,
we have a ton. We have an absolute ton of tech stories here.
We are actually really living up to our name this week because it is Canadian story, Canadian story, Canadian story, Canadian, Canadian. Two and they're not, and then another, and then a local story. It is the thoroughly Canadian tech podcast this week.
Exactly. Tons of Canadian content. We'll keep the CRTC happy.
Very happy.
So, starting with BlackBerry, they've been doing pretty well with their Priv and some stuff like that. They're trying to change their focus. They've actually acquired a new company. Why don't you tell us about it, Derek?
Well, first of all, it's great to see BlackBerry not pivoting, but looking towards the future in case the whole selling phones thing doesn't work out anymore. You're right, the Priv does seem to be doing well. However, BlackBerry OS as a whole seems to be receiving less and less attention from BlackBerry themselves and from app developers, frankly, rightfully so. So they have gone ahead and purchased a cybersecurity consulting company called Encryption with an I instead of a Y. It's based out of the UK, and this deal is worth, I think it was $3.2 billion. Where did it go?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't see the number here right now. I could have sworn there was a
$16.5 billion a year globally.
That's how much the entire consultancy is worth.
That's the whole industry.
Actually, it wasn't disclosed. I think you're thinking of further down. They talked about how they bought another company. They bought good technology for $425. They actually haven't disclosed the terms yet.
No, they haven't. And I mean, it's a publicly traded company. I'm sure it'll get exposed at some point or announced rather. But I mean, the stock is up today 0.39%. So generally, obviously, people are at least somewhat bullish on BlackBerry, and they seem to be making deals that are effectively making them relevant again by buying good technology, by buying a German security company a year or two ago, and now Encryption, based out of the UK. So they are keeping the global footprint and making sure that they have money coming in from other related but not necessarily core competencies that they do right now.
But at the same time, it also ties into what's happening with Apple, the whole encryption landscape, and basically people being aware that they maybe need to finally encrypt their stuff, and that we need to have digital security in place. So it's also good to see that being hammered home yet again with another technology company taking it seriously.
Absolutely. And I think this is also a good play for them, because again, where they're going to get most of their market penetration is in the bigger corporations where they've got the existing install base. A lot of these corporations still supply devices to their employees, and a lot of them would rather stick with BlackBerry, and that's one advantage they may have, if they end up doing this right. So, definitely a good move for the company. It gives them another possibility there. As we say, if the phones don't work out. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah.
Okay. As I guess, unless you're living under a rock, Facebook actually has added some new, I don't know what we want to call them, but reactions, I guess, is that's what Facebook calls them. So in addition to liking a story, you now have angry, sad, ha-ha, love, all this other stuff. So they basically rolled that out mid-last week, and I've seen, at least on my Facebook stream, a lot of people using different things. Here's
and
a little
for
thing.
Once, a Facebook feature went out that people didn't immediately vehemently want.
That's a good point. Excellent. Excellent point. Well, the like button's been around, if you can believe it, for 7 years.
And you know why?
You know, it's fine.
I have a feeling I know why people didn't go, oh my God, this is terrible. And that's because the like button itself is still there. The thumbs up
is
still the default reaction. Yeah. You can just click it and move on. It didn't add anything to your number of clicks or to the time you spend interacting with that feature. You can just click and move on, and it's still a like. If you want to do something else, then now you have the opportunity to partake in the enhanced, I guess would be the best way to put it, feature, whether you hover over the like button for a second or two or click it for a second or two, and then the additional reactions come up. And I've used it a few times. I mean, you know, it adds literally a second or two, and that's not a big deal for me. So I think that's why. It really didn't change. The icon changed slightly, but you don't have to do anything differently. You don't have to think differently. You can just click and move on if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, it's a good seamless experience. It's a good example of what I always talk about when UI and that, you know, make it as friction-free as possible.
Yep.
So I think you've raised an excellent point there.
It's a good user experience from a person who does front-end web development on a daily basis. I think they got it right this time. Like they like you said, they didn't massively change the user interface, but they did enhance their user experience. So, you know, that is kind of the core of what most web developers like to do, is they like to make things better. And I think this time they finally got something right without it being a massive seismic shift.
Yeah, and the other thing I like is that these reactions also include group posts from groups and brands. So a company can't block, if they have something out, a company or a brand can't block the ability to market its posts with, let's say, anger. So you know, it'll be an interesting thing to see how it goes forward. But I think it's a lot of the times people complain about Facebook and they don't want things to change. But I think this is an excellent example of a good change.
Yeah, worth noting here is that in terms of data collection, Facebook is not changing how they view reactions to a post. So they're not taking into account whether or not something makes you sad or angry, or you say yay, or you say ha-ha, as opposed to like. For now, they are treating it as you reacted to this post, therefore we think you want to see more of this type of content. A lot of people thought that this was going to mean a change to using sad or angry reactions as this being the type of thing you don't want to see, that's not the case. And ultimately, if you react in that sort of way, it's not necessarily that you don't want to see it. You don't want to see that type of content in your feed. It's that it made you sad or it made you angry. Like, I don't want to see any fewer posts about my friends, you know, relatives, and et cetera, dying. I want to know so that I can take a moment to express my condolences, maybe reach out to get information about, you know, a visitation or what have you. I want to know about those things. So I'm glad they haven't changed it yet, because the nuance around what makes you sad, what makes you angry, and why, and then therefore whether or not they should show you that more of that type of content is, that's a hairy issue.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, okay, now we move on from Facebook to the Royal Canadian Mint. You know, when I think of the Mint, I think of kind of a stodgy corporation or it's not in this country. Kind of stodgy government organization. But they've got, I remember hearing about this a couple of years ago, though I hadn't realized they'd kind of moved on. This is Mint Chimp Digital Currency, Derek.
Yeah, so. Oh, okay. This is, if you know anything about Bitcoin, this is kind of like Bitcoin in the sense that you would have a digital wallet that you need to fill up and then you could go spend it places. However, I don't believe there was anything nearly as involved as the blockchain that backs Bitcoin, and certainly not this whole Bitcoin or, you know, Mint Chimp network that needs to verify a transaction the way it does with Bitcoin or Litecoin or Feathercoin or any of the other cryptocurrencies. Basically, a mint chip could be a physical device or an app on a phone or a tablet that you would fill up with money, kind of like a prepaid Visa, and then you would use that device, again, whether it's virtual or physical, to exchange your funds. And so it's basically like cash. The Royal Canadian Mint actually ran a contest a couple of years ago and offered $50,000 in real gold to the winner of the challenge. 500 developers did submit applications. An app called Coronox, sorry, a developer named Coronox with an app called Mint Wallet for Windows Phone, I bet that's not around anymore, eventually won top prize. Unfortunately, the Mint didn't really see much uptake and probably saw this as kind of like a fun thing to do. I imagine a board of directors of some sort decided this is not a core competency, so they sold it off actually about a month and a half ago, sorry for only getting to this now, to a company called NanoPay.
I was going to say, I think that it's probably a good idea for them to sell it off. And unfortunately, I don't personally see the digital landscape accepting these things quickly. I see the digital landscape accepting more technologies like Apple Pay, et cetera, where it's not necessarily about creating these. I think people are still going to pay with cash if they want cash. They're not necessarily going to accept a digital version of it. And people care more about the seamless interaction. So as much as this is, you know, the Bitcoins and this everything are interesting, I don't see them as being something that's going to have any longevity. People care about how they can pay quickly and efficiently and securely, be that with their debit card, their credit card, with cash, whatever. But I don't think these things, I personally don't see these things catching on. Rumors are going around that MasterCard may finally be supported here in Canada for Apple Pay, which is going to open up a whole world of opportunity for Canadian customers, which I think people would rather just carry around their cell phone.
I think basically just what you're saying there, Jameson, exactly. There's a lot of, you know, compelling options already in terms of, you know, you've got MasterCard, the banks, the stuff like that, you know, bringing a whole other currency into the mix. You know, there may be something one day that might do it, but I just can't see it now. You know, there's a few people using it, but I think it's just like Bitcoin. It's another way of paying. It's, you know, like some ISPs and that will do it, but, you know, they're still taking cash. Like, it's just because cash is still king.
But at the end of the day, it's not because they're necessarily a bad idea. It's because there is so little market proliferation because the market is so tightly controlled by big companies like Visa and MasterCard and Amex.
Right.
And so like these things I don't think will take on because until MasterCard accepts Bitcoin, Bitcoin's not going to become something viable for 99% of the population.
So I disagree. And I disagree not necessarily in the short term, but I think this is a really good long-term play because, speaking to security, well, if someone steals your credit card, they can go spend some money. You might not be on the hook for it at some point, but, you know, below $40 or, you know, as soon as you call Visa or MasterCard or Amex and tell them you've lost your card, but there still is a risk that someone can get that and just and go spend some dough. Same with your debit card, especially on Tap to Pay. I love Tap to Pay, and, but I can do Tap to Pay with no other verification whatsoever, other than having my card up to $100.
So that's, which is where things like Apple Pay do create a bit more of a security. Like there is the security of having to have the fingerprint.
Yes. However, you need to have an iPhone, which is about, what, 30, 40% of market share in Canada. B, your SIM card needs to have, needs to support NFC and all the rest. So me, in my situation, I'm on a carrier where the SIM card doesn't have the NFC part built in, so I can't use the NFC on my phone for payments. Whereas something like Mint Chip, where I'm filling up a virtual Visa type thing, I think this could completely bypass the whole SIM card necessity part of things and move forward. Not to mention that Mint Chip would be a lot more like cash in the sense that transactions are anonymous. And so
it has to be, I think the biggest thing is it has to be easy for, you know, 80% of the non-tech, you know, industry to use, you know, somewhat like as easy so my mom can use it. Because until it gets like that, it's going to remain a niche. And I think that's, I can see what you're saying, how definitely the long term, but definitely more the short term, I don't see it flying as well. But, you know, all right. Let's go on. The CRTC, speaking of the CRTC, I talked about them at the beginning of the show. They mandated to the various cable and satellite companies for your TV packages that they all had to introduce a skinny package. I know we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and they had to introduce that by March 1st. It's March 2nd, so
they don't want you to know about it.
Oh, that's right. So all the major companies have released it to very little fanfare. Surprise, surprise. No surprise to any of us here, I'm sure. Pretty nothing really, kind of like meh, and it's like, you know, in the grand scheme of capitalism, they definitely don't want their customers to do this. They're definitely coming in kicking and screaming against the CRTC, almost like saying, okay, I'm going to show up. Here I am. I'm not going to like it.
Yeah.
Jameson, what do you think about some of these?
Underwhelming, and I think that they're purposely trying. They're doing everything possible to tank this idea because, like you said, they're coming into it kicking and screaming against the CRTC, knowing full well that the CRTC is 100% right. They just don't see how it can possibly be profitable for them to do it. So I think there's a bunch of hippos in their boardrooms that are very unwilling to take a look at the broader scheme of where technology is at and accept the fact that how business was done is not working for them. And that as much as, you know, the CRTC is trying to protect customers and benefit the customers, they don't see it as they're missing the point that the CRTC is trying to benefit customers and make a better experience and landscape for the customer. And they're forgetting that at the end of the day, their goal is not necessarily profit. It's about making media accessible for people. And if they were to do this properly, they would make more profit than if they are resistant and hesitant to do so.
Derek?
I'm
sitting down. I've got my popcorn out now.
No, actually, I'm going to direct this directly at Jameson. I think you are incredibly naive to think that Rogers and Bell and TELUS even care about whether or not people have access at a certain level to TV. of course they want people to pay money and to be subscribers. That's a given. But I don't think they're missing any of the points you just made. I just think they don't care. And that's ultimately to their detriment.
Which is ultimately the bigger thing that the CRTC is probably trying to get them back into thinking about.
Sure.
At the end of the day, they are purveyors of our digital landscape. They are what provide 95% of the connectivity in Canada. They provide access to all of the media for the most part, be it television, radio, newspaper, et cetera. These are the people that are running our media landscape.
But at the end of the day, they
are caring solely about profits versus the realization that if they do stuff that is beneficial to their customers, aka what their customers want, they will end up making more money.
I agree with you. As long as you have, and this isn't just with media companies, this is with companies in general. As long as the shareholder is held, you know, much higher to the detriment of anything else, you're going to have these issues. Now,
yeah.
You know, and there's all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of issues here we can talk about. You know, yeah, media concentration. We can talk about, you know, is this something like, you know, should we nationalize our connectivity, our cable lines and stuff like that, like Hydro was years ago and stuff like that. You know, there's all sorts of things, but I think just going to this issue with cable and that, I think these same, you know, hipples, as you call them in the boardroom, they're also kind of terrified because they realize there's a lot of people now, like yourself, Jameson, stuff, people coming up that are young, they're not interested in cable TV. I cut my cable TV 3 years ago. I do not miss it at all. There's a lot of people that will rather watch stuff on demand, rather watch Netflix, things like that. People just don't, you know, there's a lot of people now that just don't sit in front of what I call the idiot box for 4 hours every night.
But unfortunately, they're unwilling to make the leaps that they're terrified of making changes that will annoy some customers.
Yep. But until, you know,
versus making changes that the bulk of customers want. They're risk averse because they know they're making money currently and they don't know if they can create money doing it the other way.
And that's the problem with the system when you're a publicly traded company, because people unfortunately only look towards the next quarter until looking towards, you know, 3 or 4 years down the road. But yeah, I can certainly see some people actually, this is going to, you know, we have a story coming up in a minute. This is going to turn people off to other options.
Yeah.
Or, you know, people are going to say, do I really need this? If I only watch local news, I can hook up a digital antenna. I can watch my news online.
I get basically a little fuzzier channels than you would get, and like CBC shut down their transmitter here because apparently it wasn't financially viable. Now I will say, in a very small defense of this new basic TV package, it's what I wanted 3 years ago from Rogers.
Yeah, right.
It has the Canadian networks, it has the US networks. I just wanted to be able to watch sitcoms at night, turn my brain off, you know, and watch CBC News or what have you when I wanted to catch up on things. This is what I wanted 3 years ago. But 2 years ago, I got a Roku box and canceled cable and went to Netflix, and it really hasn't been that bad. So,
exactly.
And especially when there are still not quite, you know, very gray area ways to get the rest of that stuff I do want that's not on Netflix, why would I bother dropping $25 a month still? Like, that's really the crux of it, is not only did the CRTC need to do this, they really should have mandated pure pick-and-play options so that I could get, for, let's say, $1 a channel, I could get CBC News and, you know, CBC proper, two or three Canadian networks, three or four American networks, because there are more of them, done. That would have been ideal. I mean, my house doesn't speak French very often, you know, only when my oldest is learning it and I'm helping them out. So I don't want the French language channels, no offense, francophones, or any of the other ones that are in these packages. So because I don't need them. And if I need them, I should be able to choose them. That's a real free market spin on this.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it's still not good enough for a lot of people.
Yeah. And I think ultimately, if these companies were caring about capitalism, they would arguably probably do that in a heartbeat. Unfortunately, there are so many old white hats in the room that they don't care about that. They, like you said, Stuart, care about the next quarter, and they don't see that as being a way to actually massively amp up their next quarter. So,
yeah.
Right, exactly. All right. Free TV for life. It's here, and it may even be legal. Now, this is one story that you found, Derek, in the CBC business section. Why don't you fill us in on this?
I do, and I know many people who have these. I do not, full disclosure. It has been offered to me. My dad's offered to buy one for me, but I keep saying no. So basically, I mean, there's really no secret here. There are people online on eBay or even Superior Computers down in Lambeth selling these mm-hmm. Android-based free TV boxes that give you access to live sports, live cable stations, and I'm talking like HBO, CBC, Global, NBC, CBS, Fox, etc. Usually they cost between $100 to $200 a month, depending on the processor and the RAM and the storage and that sort of thing. It's usually a hardware difference. And it seems that because these boxes only stream the ultimately pirated feeds to your device, you're not downloading anything, and therefore, you're not actually breaking the law. The feeds are. The people who set up the feeds almost certainly are, no matter where they're mm-hmm. from.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You as the consumer are not. Of course, and this is what I asked a guy at Superior Computers a few months ago when I was there, what about the morality behind it? I mean, I just up and quit on cable, period. But I am paying for content through Netflix, and that is 98% of my watching, my viewing. Maybe 95%, because we watch a little bit of YouTube too. But you know, the vast majority of my viewing is through Netflix, which is a legal paid service, and the Canadian Netflix as well, not the American one. And so I straight up and asked the guy, I'm like, don't you feel bad about you know, selling these boxes that in some way are illegal, and sure enough, they are. And he's like, no, he just kind of shrugged it off. I said, okay, but, you know, basically we're finding out that, you know, there's a lot of people now making some decent coin on the side, if they're North American, because I don't think anybody's big enough quite yet to, or selling enough of these to do it as a full-time job, but... Yeah, it's actually getting extremely simple to get an Android box, probably made and manufactured in China, throw Android on there. Yeah. Actually, Android comes preloaded. Get a few different apps like Kodi and some other ones, and suddenly you've got access to, and I kid you not, live NHL games, live soccer games from Portugal, Germany, England, etc. You probably could have watched the Super Bowl. And right now, there's nothing legally stopping you from doing that. And I think that's a very interesting turn that puts even more pressure on Bell, TELUS, Rogers, etc. to get their, or Videotron, to get their stuff together and be a lot more consumer-friendly.
It's true. Go ahead, Jameson.
I'm having flashbacks to when media, or when audio first had this problem. And I think that ultimately, over time, I get people want stuff for free, but at the same time, the quality and caliber of media goes down the cheaper it gets.
Yeah.
I will happily pay money to Netflix and to other companies that are putting on good content. It's not that I don't want to pay for media. I want to pay for media. It's just I want to pay for media to and the ability to consume it in different ways than what are traditionally available. And I think ultimately these boxes, well, you know, there's personally, I think they should probably be shut down, not because of any immorality, but mainly because it's going to they have the potential to destroy our media landscape. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much about not wanting things for free or for cheap. It's just that if you want good quality media, you need to pay for it. Yeah. People need to be paid for their time, for actors, for writers, for producers. Like, all of these people have jobs that they need to make money off of.
Yeah, I think this is what Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's as much as people don't want to pay for these things, they need to realize that they have to pay for these things if they want them to continue to exist.
Yeah, but I really feel like this is just one step too far. It's just putting like half your foot over the line.
Yep.
Okay, just to play devil's advocate for a second, but like, didn't we hear some similar arguments from the various record companies and stuff like that when, you know, MP3s first came out and Napster and all that sort of stuff? But then eventually what happened was, and you said too, you know, if content's available and it's easy to get to, it's good quality, as I said before, there's less friction.
The reason, it's the iTunes effect.
People are going to buy it, yeah. And we've seen that with when Netflix came out. I know recently there was a report that it actually, you know, they figure it helped reduce piracy.
Right.
There was a story I saw the other day. Here we go. BitTorrent accounted for, they did a study. This was in 2014. BitTorrent was 2.8% of the traffic, a significant drop from 7.6%. Where Netflix was up, it was almost 35%. And I think, you know, I think in some ways, yeah, these things are, I see what you're saying, because it's definitely very easy. It's unlike people using Napster and that. It was easy for people, you know, all the geeks and that knew how to do it. You know, Joe and Jane Sixpack didn't. Now these things definitely bring it into the common masses.
I think ultimately these are trying to solve a problem that the rest of the media landscape is still tackling with. Netflix is good from the standpoint of you've got access to television and movies and things like that. But like you said, Derek, this gives you the ability to watch things like sports events that are live, et cetera. And part of the problem right now is that there is no frictionless way for the masses to consume those events really easily. And so this is a way to do so. I think most people would happily pay $5 a month to have access to NFL. But it's not just about having access to NFL or NHL. It's about having access to it in a frictionless and easy way to do it. And ultimately, I think right now that's the problem, is that these are taking off because it gives people the ability to watch the things they want to watch, particularly live events, where there isn't an easy way to do so while paying for it or something like that.
Yeah, we're still in transition, basically. For me personally, the big problem with getting access to live sports is that at this point it would be cheaper for me to just go back to cable than it would be for me to try and subscribe to NFL's Game Pass and NBA League Pass and NHL Game Center.
It's the chicken and egg solution for them, because they don't want to drop their price because they don't want to lose money, but at the same time they aren't going to get more people watching it if they don't drop their price.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just not willing. I don't want to watch every NHL game this year. I want to watch Blackhawks games, and the NHL does not provide a per team subscription. The NBA does, but of course the Raptors are owned by media companies, so the Raptors are on a completely different service. They're not part of League Pass. But I think League Pass for one team was like $40. For 5 or 6 months of basketball, maybe the playoffs, that's worth it. That's not an issue. So if I could pay, I don't know, okay, 30 teams in the NHL, it's like $300 for the whole season. If you could, so that's only technically $10 a team. If you charged me $20 or even $30 per team for the season, I'd pay that. Yep. I'd pay $30 for the season, which is technically three times more than what it's worth to pay for the whole thing. But because
and that's a perfect example of how that will work, exactly.
And I'm sure they'll get there, but we're not there yet at all.
And so these, and ultimately that means that these free box, these quote-unquote free TV boxes are taking off because it's a way for the average consumer to consume the media they want to consume and arguably probably will happily pay for. It's just that there is no good way to do so yet.
Right. Yeah. And I can certainly see some, I don't know, again, I haven't ever played with any of these boxes, so I'm assuming, you know, as sites get shut down, there must be some mechanism that it suggests other ones. And I think, yeah, sooner or later, you're going to have more and more of these. There'll be less reasons as well. People who don't necessarily have an unlimited data plan or could potentially run into trouble when their overage bill comes in from their ISP.
Yeah, now, but you know what? There's so many ways around that. Like the caps now, if you're smart with a smaller
you buy unlimited.
ISP,
yeah, no, I didn't realize
like,
that.
Well, not even that. If you're with a smaller ISP like Start or ExecuLink or TechSavvy, your cap started like 300 gigabytes a month.
Yeah.
I mean, I go over
and
that.
And streaming
but,
uses less.
Yeah,
and streaming uses less than downloading. Like, you know, fair, you know, here's a disclosure. We do download the odd thing using BitTorrent, the odd TV show from England that we just cannot get here.
Right.
So, yes. So
yeah,
I see how much those
there?
Are.
If you legitimately
exactly.
can't get a show like the latest season of, well, no, that's a bad example because it's on iTunes. Okay, I'll use
Marvel's
it as an
Avengers
example.
Of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Sorry?
Avengers, S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
No, I was going to say a British show called Luther, but there's a season pass on iTunes. But regardless,
yeah, there's more happening that way. But like a lot of the stuff that my wife and I like to watch, you just cannot get.
Right.
They're not they're documentaries or stuff like that. And I've long maintained that the BBC.
Like 9 Cats Out of 10, some of the British panel shows. Like you can't get those on the Canadian channels at all.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of some of the documentary stuff, the nature shows.
Sure.
And, you know, I've long maintained if the BBC had if they had their service, you truly could, like they have BBC iPlayer, but you have to be in England because you have to pay your television license. But if they had a subscription model where I could access the BBC catalog, I'd be the first to sign up in a heartbeat.
I'd probably pay for BBC. It is really good. And I love some of those panel shows. They're hilarious. So if Channel 4,
like
BBC, if any of you are listening...
Yep.
Please make your stuff available here in Canada. We love it. We eat it up. I know so many Americans and Canadians who love British panel shows. How about this? Panel.tv. It's just panel shows from across BBC, Channel 4, Channel 3, whatever other Channel 5. I know there's a bunch of stupid names. Like, just make all the panel shows available. I'll pay $5 or $10 a month just for that.
There you go.
Yeah, it's frustrating. But anyway, well, I think we've killed the horse and
beaten this one to death.
Yeah, this one to death. So let's move on to Uber.
Uber. Tell us about Uber.
Oh, well, what about them?
Let's focus
on the issue at hand. Insurance is a big issue because, of course, if you decide to become an Uber X driver, for instance, so you are literally just driving around whenever you feel like it, or like making yourself available whenever you feel like it, whenever you can, and picking people up and dropping them off, then your personal insurance, no way in hell, is going to cover an issue or an accident during that time period. Alberta, the province of Alberta and Uber, I know, are working towards making new rules, new insurance rules to make sure that that sort of thing is covered, or making kind of like a pseudo, somewhere between personal and business or commercial auto insurance policy that will cover that sort of use case. And Intact has actually said that they will have, at some point this year, an insurance policy designed specifically for this.
And fair note, that's got to surprise me because I used to work for Intact.
Yes.
And I swear they were the most stodgiest, you know, I'm blown away by that. But anyway,
now
here's an interesting question.
Well, hang on.
Hang on. Go ahead.
One more thing.
Go ahead.
The reason this has come up again, because that was last September, the reason this has come up again is that on February 1st, Aviva has also said that they will actually become the first company in the country to offer personal coverage for ride-sharing drivers.
Now, I got to tell you, working in the insurance business, that's just because Intact did it. Because Aviva and Intact are like the Hatfields and the McCoys. It's quite
funny. Yeah. Or it's just like when Rogers, Bell, and Telus all simultaneously raised the rates by $5 a month. Somebody else did it first, and so everybody else jumps on the bandwagon.
You mean it's not coincidence?
Such a coincidence. Yes, absolutely. Such a coincidence.
You mean it's not coincidence? They don't talk to each other?
No. Never.
What's the London Executive Club?
What? Anyway.
What? You know. Okay. Here's something interesting. I wonder if, with this insurance thing, if I'm a taxi driver and I'm paying a sky-high taxi rate, I wonder what's going to be different. If I'm a taxi driver, maybe I should go to the Uber rate. What's the difference going to be?
Because it doesn't cover ride-sharing for more than 20 hours a week, Aviva said.
So this is very much
a distinction between part-time and full-time thing. So that's right in here. It's going to, depending on you, the driver, and of course your vehicle, Aviva said it's going to add between 33, it's quite the range, $33 and $230 per month to add this extra coverage. And it will also depend on whether you have customers up to 10 hours a week in your vehicle or up to 20 hours a week. So there are going to be, you're going to have to, you know, look at
that's
your lifestyle, I guess.
That's a lot of surge pricing. I'm just saying.
So, you know, if this is very much a couple times a week thing for you, you'd probably be closer to the $33 a month extra fee. If this is closer to 20 and maybe you're in a urban area that already has higher rates than normal, like Calgary or Toronto, you're probably going to be closer to the $230 a month mark.
Right. Jameson, any thoughts on this?
I think ultimately the takeaway from this is that whether or not the taxi companies like it, the rest of the world is accepting the fact that these things are going to happen.
Yeah.
And so I think ultimately these rates will change over time. And, you know, 2 years down the road, we might be looking at something that's a lot more beneficial to potential customers. But for now, it's just good to see the market moving ahead. And technology moving ahead, regardless of people not wanting it to.
Exactly. All right, moving on. This is a story I kind of like because I'm still a gamer, but I'm a gamer on the PC. I have an Xbox, but I absolutely suck at Xbox games because it doesn't have a keyboard and a mouse. So other than driving games and maybe top-down sports games, I don't play a lot of shooters and stuff like that on things like Xbox and that. But Microsoft, they've got an interesting – they had a press event last week. And their big plans – and they've talked about this before, but they want to unify PC and Xbox One platforms. So basically one ecosystem – running something called Universal Window Applications. So, you know, ultimately the idea is that I may actually be able to play Titanfall on my PC at some point. And I'll be able to play. Now, we've seen this already with Warframe, but I could be, you know, Jameson, you could have an Xbox, I could have a PC, and we could both be in the same game instance.
Exactly. I have three things to say on this.
Okay.
One,
should
we're
I
only going to give you
two. We're only going to give you two, so too bad.
Oh, well, three. Number one, about freaking time.
Right.
They've been running pretty much stock hardware in the 360 and the X-Phone for how many years?
Since
the original. Like, this should have been happening from day one. Number two, I think they kind of have to. Because if you take a look at what Steam's doing with SteamOS and the ability to mirror and play games regardless of the platform, you know, with controllers or keyboard, et cetera. And like you said, Warframe, there are games that are actively doing this. So I think it's not surprising to see them do it, but it's definitely, they were forced into it. Number three, from a person who has devoted far too much time into video game achievements, I just hope that they convert, make it so that you can, that all of those things become, cross-platform completely, so that it's no longer you're dealing with sort of things stand on their own. For me, as a gamer, it's not necessarily so much about, yes, it's nice to play things cross-platform play and all that stuff, but it's about the experience being unified across all my devices, from achievements to store purchases to all of those things wrapped into it.
All right. I also have three things to say, but it's going to take a lot less time.
Okay.
One, I agree. it's about time. Two, I don't care. This doesn't apply to me at this point in my life at all. Three, don't care, and I don't care because I'm ready for really good virtual reality instead. I really feel like I'm finally going to be able to enjoy first-person shooter games because in the next 5 years, I will actually have a pretend plastic device in my hand that I will be able to point, and when I point in the different direction, it will actually respond appropriately and far more accurately than a Nintendo Wii or the PlayStation Move, of course. And when I pull a trigger, it will pull a trigger. And when I get up and get down, it will, you know, it's actually going to respond to my headgear and whatever I've got in my hands. And frankly, at this point, I don't care how big it is or how heavy it is. that's really the only way at this point I'm able to suspend my disbelief and feel like I'm in the game. The graphics are incredibly realistic now. I saw a demo of Star Wars Battlefront. Is that what it's called?
Yep.
And when some person enabled this enhanced lighting mod on top of it, and it blew my mind. Some of the levels looked so photorealistic. If I had a big enough screen and it was wrapped around me, I honestly wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So that's great. We are getting there in terms of a truly immersive experience. And when we are there, I will drop $2,000 or $3,000 for the opportunity to get out of real life for a little bit and then have a good time doing something else, whether it's blowing somebody's brains out, and I'm sorry that sounds like a fun time sometimes, or even doing something like really potentially childish, like Pikmin from the N64 and GameCube, like being in that sort of like God mode type world, being able to interact in a completely different way, I think would be a lot of fun for an hour. So I'm ready for that. I'm done with looking at a TV for my gaming experience for the most part.
Okay, I know your first two were quick. Your third one was long.
I know that you guys don't watch anime, but there's a great one called Sword Art Online, which
Who said I don't watch anime?
Okay, fair enough. I assumed. My bad. Anyways, there's a show. It's on Netflix. It's called Sword Art Online, and the whole premise of it is that you do these full neural dives into a virtual reality MMO world where you cease to physically exist. You're being directly neurally linked. And I look forward to that type of immersive experience. I don't necessarily want to be holding something. I want to neurologically be there. I want to not be in the risk of physically damaging something in my apartment. I look forward to that stuff, which hopefully will come along sooner rather than later, because apparently there's a company in Japan that is working on exactly that.
With IBM. So,
yeah, well, we'll see. But,
no, it is with IBM.
No, I know. I know how it turns out. But that's the type of experience which I think we'll eventually get to. Hopefully, in the meantime, we can at least have some shiny things like combined platforms that make it easier to develop things like semi-VR environments, etc. Because once you've got a unified gaming platform to work off of, you can then go and do some of those cool things a little bit easier. And more available to everyone. So
right,
yeah.
Okay, we're getting low on time here, so we're going to finish up here. We have a local story, Derek. You found this one.
I did. So if you listen to this Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, the London Farm Show is actually happening over at the Western Fair District right now. In that vein of things, a local company called A&L Canada Laboratories, based right here in London, Ontario, has unveiled a new unmanned aerial vehicle, also known as a drone, that is built specifically to help farmers, at this point in its current iteration, pick up data about their crops. And so it'll actually fly over your crops. It has a bunch of sensors inside. I'm not going to go all into it. You can look at the show notes. It's going to look at the quality of your crops and you know, everything that's growing there. And within 10 minutes, we'll actually start feeding data to your tablet or your phone, if you're close enough, and start giving you some fairly instant insight into your crop production that you have going on right there in front of you.
Very
and
cool.
So this is very cool to see happening, A, here in the area, and B, for the agriculture industry. I think it's been extremely overlooked by product developers as a whole, and it's great to see something coming up that merges a lot of hot industries right now, whether it's drone, sensors, you know, microcomputing, and all that sort of stuff.
And we've talked about before, there's so much, the agribiz now has gone so high tech with some of this stuff, but I'm looking at the picture of this thing, and, you know, I think they'll probably have an option pack. It looks like something, you know, you'd see from a Luftwaffe 1946 Saturday morning cereal. Does it have an option where it also drops a bomb on your neighbor's crop?
It does kind of look like a B-2 bomber, yes.
Yeah, it looks pretty badass.
Well, and then on the other hand, the finish kind of makes it look like it's from World War II.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It looks like a flying wing. It looks like one of Jack Northrop's flying wings or something. But yeah, no, I think this is a fabulous thing. And yeah, I've been to one of these, a couple of the farm shows before, and the high tech stuff, like, you know, they talk about where you've got, you know, these $250,000 combines that can basically guide, that will drive through the field on GPS and do the exact optimal route. You can practically sit back in your air conditioned cab, have your coffee, listen to your music, read a book, and this thing's driving for you.
No, and listen to the Canadian Tech podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, exactly.
That too, because it's got the satellite connection.
Yep.
Exactly. They'll reach us from satellite as well. So, yep, definitely a good thing. I'll see if I can find I'll see if these guys are on Twitter. We'll definitely do a shout out to them, to A&L Canada. But yeah, fabulous thing. And yeah, if you ever get a chance to go to that farm show, it's kind of cool.
Just
interesting. Yeah, kind of see all the interesting things. So, okay, what we like. I think we still have enough time here. I'm going to go first this time.
Do it.
All right, we're going to do it. Raspberry Pi. They've unleashed the Raspberry Pi 3.
Yes.
Back when I get some time again, I really want to get my hands on one of these for two reasons. A, it's $35, full Wi-Fi, full anything. It's got a nice quad-core 1.2 gig quad-core ARM processor, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, you name it, it has it. What else do we have here with it? Oh, the other thing I like about it, I should say, is that it also runs a stripped-down version of Windows 10, IoT. I assume that stands for Internet of Things.
It does.
Derek, what do you think of this?
I love it. This is the Pi I've been waiting for. I don't care about pecan pie. I don't care about pecan pie and apple pie anymore. I have ordered it. I want one so bad. My wife actually came to me a week ago. Speaking of my 2 or 3% of TV viewing I don't do over Netflix, I was plugging in the laptop into the TV, and I was moving all these vases aside on the mantle so I could put the laptop there and load up Popcorn Time. And she goes, "If we had a Raspberry Pi, would you have to do all this?" And I turn around with a big smile on my face, and I said, "Nope." And she just kind of like started stroking her chin and thinking, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, it's coming. This is exactly the moment I've been waiting for. I just have to wait her out." And so, I've bought one on the company dime, and I've got a Raspberry Pi 3 coming in as soon as it's in stock. It's got everything. It has Bluetooth now. It has Wi-Fi now. It's still $35 US. It's got HDMI out. Like, it really has everything I need to. And I'm not even worried about pirating stuff. It's just sometimes I need a different device to hook up to my TV. And like, the Roku is great, but it doesn't have apps for everything. So I need basically a small computer. So that's what I'm getting.
Right. Exactly. Very cool. All right. Moving on. Derek, what have you got this week?
I've done a lot of talking. I'm really sorry.
You're
going full on DevOps on this one.
I sure am. Okay. So I needed to feel like I was learning something new again. And so I decided to dive into Docker last night. Docker, if you know anything about virtualized computing, like VMware, Xen, you know, the virtual hypervisor or the virtual hypervisors, the hypervisors that make that let you run multiple virtual machines on a single physical server. You've probably heard of Docker. Docker is like another level of abstraction. Basically, you're virtualizing the application, but you're not streaming, you know, Microsoft Word over a Xen app connection between a thin client and a streaming server on the back end. This is different. This is more about taking an application you've built and wrapping it up in what's called a container so that it's easily distributable. So basically,
the primary reason, at least from the developer standpoint, is so that you can have the same environment locally as what you do on the end machine.
Yes, and the last thing you have to worry about is your config files or your environment files and all that sort of stuff, because you can build your development environment or your production environment if you need a highly repetitive stack like Apache, MySQL, etc. You add all those applications and then you run a couple commands and it turns it into a container. You push your container up to a repo just like a developer like Jameson does for his code, and it's there. And you can pull it down and it runs exactly the way you had it set at that time. And I found recently that I really need something to build, and so I thought, well, I'm going to dive into Docker. I'm going to learn what this is about. I can't use it for CleverHost yet. I'd love to find a reason or a way to use it, but even just with the Pi and with my own messing around on the side, I really wanted to understand Docker better, so I dove into it last night, and I love it. So is this
Being the non-programmer in the room, is this a bit like when you have like Wine? I think it's Wine that you can set up like you can bundle a whole application into like a single. Am I thinking of Wine?
Yeah, kind of.
I think something else for the Mac. I've seen it lets you run.
Yeah,
it's kind of that idea.
More or less, and like the nice thing is that the container does come with like a really bare bones operating system, and then whatever applications you put on top. So it's like Docker on its own runs exactly the same way across Windows, Linux, Mac OS X. And so that is definitely one of the nice things is that the containers are extremely portable. And so the same container can run on a Windows host or a Linux host or a Mac host. I'm messing around with it on my MacBook, but I could take it to a Linux Mint machine at home or Ubuntu and pull the container from the repo, from the repository, and hit run, and it runs exactly the same way. I guess the best way to think about it is you are eliminating all those dependencies that you typically rely on people to resolve themselves. Like, hey, don't forget to install MySQL. Don't forget to install Apache. Don't forget to install the PHP development libraries or RPMs, etc.
Right.
You bundle all those things. So the containers can be rather large, but you're eliminating the hassle of writing out this super complex list of requirements, system requirements, prior to somebody loading your container. And, you know, if it's a commercial thing, paying for it.
It's the developer's equivalent of Mac's mantra of it just works.
Okay. Yes.
Cool.
Well, which is not true, by the way. I'm finding that increasingly that mantra is not true at all about Mac. But anyway.
We won't go there.
We only have an hour.
That's a whole other show. All right, Jameson.
All right.
What's yours?
So mine, I'm going to put a big caveat in front of this. It is still beta, but it's the whole idea is that we shouldn't have to pay exorbitant amounts of money to secure websites. And so it's a certificate authority for SSL certificates that provide them for free. And it's called Let's Encrypt. The idea being that as the tech world increasingly gets more and more complicated and complex and hacking happens more frequently, that we need the ability to encrypt all websites. And so this is very much still in beta, but hopefully will lead to the ability of SSL certificates being widely available for everyone and easy to do. So
very cool. All right. Well, gentlemen, I think we are done. That was a fabulous show.
Mm-hmm.
Nice and long, lots of Canadian content, lots of meaty Canadian content,
yes,
which is good. So again, our friends at the CRTC should be happy with us. All right, so for episode 62 of the Canadian Tech Podcast for Wednesday, March the 2nd, 2016, my name is Stuart Clark.
My name is Derek Silva.
And I'm Jameson Roberts.
Thank you, and be well.
Tech Podcast was brought to you by CleverHost. CleverHost was founded on the idea that web hosting should be available to everyone for almost anything they can dream up at a very affordable cost. By providing customers with an award-winning control panel, a great account management system, and almost every tool imaginable to build great websites, we strive to provide each customer with a web hosting experience they can rave about. Visit cleverhost.ca today and use promo code CTP10 to get 10% off your first invoice.